Peralta threw two-hit ball for a career-high 8 innings, and Manny Pena singled home a run, leading the Brewers to a 1-0 victory and a 3-game sweep of the Reds yesterday. The defending NL champs improved to 6-1, 2 games better than last year's start, when they tied the club record with 96 wins. Elsewhere, Atlanta beat the Cubs 6-4. The Braves took advantage of 5 walks by Cubs relievers in the 8th. The White Sox over the Indians 8-3. In the NBA, the Bulls beat the Wizards 115-114. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Scattered rain showers today, temperatures in the low 40s, east winds at 10 to 15 miles per hour. A chance of more rain tonight, a low around 37. Mostly cloudy tomorrow, dry, warmer. Tomorrow's high around 52. Then looking ahead to the weekend, partly sunny skies on Saturday, a high of 57. The normal for this time of year, by the way, is 49. Then for Sunday, a chance of showers and possibly thunderstorms. Sunday's high, 63. Right now, 42. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up.
We'll be spending most of today's morning show talking with best-selling author Stephen Brill, a name that you very well might know for the contributions that he has made to New York Magazine, Fortune, Esquire, The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine. You may know the name also as the founder of Court TV, and someone who has written considerably on the matter of law in the country. He is someone who has appeared on a number of different television networks. He teaches journalism at Yale University and is co-founder of NewsGuard and the author of a new book called Tailspin, The People and Forces Behind America's 50-Year Fall and Those Fighting to Reverse It. The book begins with a description of what Stephen Brill sees as a number of signs that the United States is not the same nation that it once was, that it is not holding true to the values that made us who we are, and that there are all kinds of signs that that there could be even more serious steeps of decline in the years ahead. And his book is a call to stop that decline and to reverse it if at all possible. But he points to really interesting, let's say, unexpected culprits in terms of how America's found itself in the situation that it does. And he outlines this in meticulous fashion in his very intriguing and important book. Again, the book is titled Tailspin. It is published by Vintage Book, which is a division of Penguin Random House. Stephen Brill, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, and thank you for that description.
Before we get into your book, Tailspin, I want to take just a moment to ask you about something which you have co-founded, which is called NewsGuard. And it seems to me that this is something that is exceedingly important in this day and age. Explain to our listeners what NewsGuard is and what prompted you to create it.
Sure. NewsGuard is an online service using human intelligence, not artificial intelligence, which I'll explain in a minute, to combat misinformation and disinformation, sometimes called fake news. And what we've done is we have hired dozens of journalists under my supervision, journalists at various levels, who have now read and written nutrition labels for and provided a red and green rating for the 2,200 news and information websites in the United States responsible for 96% of the information consumed online. So if your listeners go to newsguardtech.com, they can download for free a browser plugin extension for their Chrome browser, their Edge browser, their Safari browser, you name it. And once they do, whenever they see a Twitter news feed, a Facebook news feed, do a Google search or a Bing search or anything else, they will see the NewsGuard red or green icon. And if they hover over it, they can start to read the nutrition label. Now, these ratings and labels are not based on, you know, whether we like a website or don't like a website, whether we think it's conservative or liberal. They're based on 9 specific journalistic standards and how these websites adhere to those standards. For example, do they disclose their ownership? Do they have a corrections policy? Have they been found repeatedly to publish false news? Do they gather and present news and information responsibly using responsible sources? So there are the 9 criteria. They're weighted, and if you get a score of 60 or more, you get a green. If you don't, you get a red. But the important thing is it's all explained completely transparently. It's not an algorithm. It's not a black box. You can see exactly what we did. If we interview the websites before we say anything bad about them, algorithms don't call people for comment. We do. And you can see our process right there, and you can comment on it. The publishers can comment on it. And as a result, what we've found, we've done a survey using the Gallup organization, is that people who download the plugin and see our ratings agree that it is completely apolitical. It's not leaning liberal or conservative, and are less inclined to share red-rated sites and more inclined to share green-rated sites. So the goal is to make sense of the Internet. It used to be if you walked into a library, if you walk into a library, you see books arranged neatly by subject matter. You know who the publisher is. You know who the author is. You can read the book jacket and get a biography of the author. And there's a librarian there who's explaining to you, this would be a good source for this. This is a good source, but they tend to be a little conservative. You should take that with a grain of salt, or they tend to be a little liberal. You should know that. The Internet is as if you walked into a library with 3 trillion pieces of paper just flying around in the air, and you grab one piece of paper, and you start reading it, and you don't know who wrote it. You don't know who the publisher is. You don't know who financed it. You have no idea of how reliable it is. So what we're doing is what librarians have done since the invention of libraries. And by the way, that's why libraries all across the country have downloaded the browser plugin for NewsGuard and installed it on their computers for their patrons to use.
Wow.
So it's human intelligence, not artificial intelligence, to solve a misinformation problem.
Can I ask how many people are hard at work doing this? Because as you said, this is something that is being generated by human beings. And I just can't imagine how many people it would take to do that.
No. Well, you'd be surprised because we're not fact-checking individual articles. So in other words, if the Milwaukee Journal publishes something today that is not accurate, we're not going to solve that problem because the Milwaukee Journal gets a green because it's generally quite a reliable news organization. So by rating sites, not individual articles, we achieve that 96% scale with approximately 36 journalists here in New York and in Chicago. And, we're constantly updating them. If some new site pops up, we get an alert about it and we rate it very quickly. So it's the scale is achieved, again, by rating sites, not individual articles, although we do, we sample articles. We use the work of the fact-checking organizations. We always re-report that work. So that's how we achieve the scale.
Very good. And just to reiterate what I think is one of your most important points, unlike some other services that might do something maybe vaguely related to this, you are completely transparent in terms of how the rating that you assign has been calculated.
That's correct. So, for example, you know, every newspaper, every, you know, every website, your website, you know, BuzzFeed, you name it, has a reliability and trustworthy rating from Facebook, Google, and Twitter that informs their algorithms about how prominently they will display that. The problem is none of those news organizations have any idea what their rating is. They can't talk to anyone about it because no one will tell them what it is. If they want to complain about it, they can't because they don't have anyone to complain to and they don't know what it is. And yet for commercial news organizations, that kind of rating on those platforms determines their advertising revenue. So it's dollars and cents. It's their very financial viability, and it's completely unaccountable. With us, if someone wants to dispute our rating, for example, if they say, well, we actually have a corrections policy, you got that wrong, they call us and they tell us and we check and we correct the mistake. We say who made the mistake. We say how we made the mistake and we apologize. And by the way, since we've launched this, more than 500 news organizations around the United States have actually changed their practices to get a higher score from NewsGuard.
Wow. Well, I commend you for that very important work. We're speaking with Stephen Brill, and now we will turn our attention to the primary matter at hand, his latest book, a New York Times bestseller titled Tailspin, The People and Forces Behind America's 50-Year Fall and Those Fighting to Reverse It. As books like this typically do, it begins in a place that might lead us to really abject despair. You do take a moment to say that we are not in the midst of anything like the American Civil War. We are not in the midst of anything like the Great Depression, to cite probably the two darkest chapters in America's past. But having said that, you see all sorts of alarming signs of decline in all kinds of different aspects of American life. Without taking too much time, just summarize for our listeners what prompts you to assess our current state of affairs in such negative terms.
Well, frankly, since I wrote the book, it's been a lot less difficult for me to persuade people of that premise because it's just been more of the same. But let's take two examples. It is literally true in the United States today that the average person does not expect that, the average 25 or 30-year-old does not expect that they will be more prosperous than their parents, and their parents don't expect that their children will be more prosperous than them. That is a total reversal of everything that's been true about the United States since the beginning of the United States. And their expectations happen to be accurate. Income mobility in this country has almost been frozen. And, you know, that's what the American dream is all about. So that's one example. The second example is more tangible, and that's the infrastructure problem. Mm. It used to be that infrastructure was not a political issue. Politicians on both sides of the aisle, you know, thought long term and knew they had a civic responsibility to invest in the future. So when President Eisenhower in the 1950s proposed this seemingly radical idea of let's invest billions of dollars in an interstate highway system, because he knew from his experience with World War II that our infrastructure wasn't bringing supplies to factories on time and factories couldn't deliver them on time, et cetera. So he had this crazy idea. Let's do an interstate highway system. The federal government would pay for it. We'd raise gasoline taxes to finance it. Democrats and Republicans alike supported it. And they did this in the late 1950s, knowing that the fruits of it wouldn't be evident to voters until the end of the 1960s and, you know, into the 1970s when they'd be out of office. That's a different kind of politician than we have today. The idea today that we can't get together as liberals and conservatives, Democrats, Republicans, and say we, you know, our highways are crumbling. The data about the cost of car repairs, the data about the amount of time people are stalled in traffic, the data about our crumbling power system, constant power outages all over the place. We don't think long term, and we don't think about the common good. So no Democrat is going to vote for a Republican president's infrastructure program, and no Republican is going to vote for a Democratic president's infrastructure program. Now that used to be literally as American as apple pie. So those are two examples. The book, of course, has dozens of examples, and the root of all that, has to do with five or six trends that began in the late 1960s that seemed like really good things, and that ended up having a boomerang effect because people who rose to the top in the meritocracy, which is another thing that began happening in the late 1960s, which I was a beneficiary of, people who rose to the top in the meritocracy were so smart and so overachieving that they locked down their advantages. So to come back to infrastructure, they made sure that taxes on the wealthy would go down, not up, and therefore the country wouldn't be able to finance infrastructure. They made sure that they could hire all kinds of lobbyists to protect every other interest they had in Washington, and the lobbyists were readily available because in the new meritocracy, the economy of the United States basically became a paper economy. Lawyers and bankers and people like that, not a manufacturing economy.
This is another symptom as well of the widening income gap that we have seen between the poorest and the wealthiest, and of course the high level of poverty in the United States, very high for what is otherwise a highly developed nation. And you explore a lot of different things as you talk about this sad state of affairs. One of the most intriguing things you say is that the story is not about villains, although there are some, nor is it about a conspiracy to bring the country down. I think this touches on something you just said in your brief description about how much of what has fed this current state of affairs is not based on evil intentions and perhaps in many cases on the best of intentions, but best of intentions
exactly.
That have somehow gone awry.
Sure, exactly. Let me take another example. The First Amendment. We all believe in the First Amendment, right? So if I told you, let's go back to 1976. Ralph Nader, the consumer advocate, brings a lawsuit contesting the constitutionality of a law in Virginia that didn't allow discount pharmacies to advertise their discounted prices. The law had been passed by the incumbent big pharmacies in Virginia who didn't like the idea of competition from discounters. So Nader goes to the Supreme Court, ends up in the Supreme Court, and says the First Amendment is just as important for listeners as it is for speakers. And what he means by that is, the drugstores may be corporations, but so what? They're advertising discounts, and poor people and the elderly will benefit from these discounts on drugs. And the Supreme Court says, you're right. The First Amendment doesn't just depend on speakers. It has to do with the Constitution's responsibility to listeners. Your right and my right to hear about, in this case, the discounting of drugs. So that wipes out the notion that corporations can't bring a First Amendment lawsuit. Cut to 2008 or 9, whenever it was, you get the Citizens United case, which nails down the idea that corporations can donate money freely to political campaigns because they have First Amendment rights too. So what you have is Ralph Nader, the ultimate liberal consumer advocate, launching a trail of litigation where very smart lawyers end up using it in a perfectly legal and ethical way to make an argument that that corporations should have a right to dominate political campaigns with huge contributions of money. How's that for a boomerang?
No kidding. So you are pointing to, as you already touched on, the rise of a meritocracy in the United States, which has become, in a sense, a new aristocracy. And you find that actually this meritocracy is as entrenched as any past age aristocracy ever was, but the sort of the mechanism of entrenchment is perhaps a little different.
Sure, that's the ultimate irony. I got into Yale College and Yale Law School on a scholarship, you know, based, I hope, on merit. I didn't have the money to go, and that was part of a drive in the late 1960s and 70s to, buy the better, colleges all across the country to provide economic opportunity to people who otherwise would not be able to afford to go to those places. That's obviously a great thing, right? It's much better that, you know, someone can get in on, quote, the merits, unquote, than that someone get in because his grandfather donated a building there. Okay? Everybody would agree with that. Turns out that people like me, we had children, and we had made some money, and we wanted our children to go to the best, private schools, if need be, to get, coaching for the SATs and all that. And long story short, the meritocrats of the 1970s have produced their own aristocracy, except it's much more defensible because we can all say we did it on the merits. And, the culmination of that, which I must admit my book did not predict, is not only, spending money on coaching and on, the best private schools and on music lessons and all the other stuff that, that parents do to get their kids into good colleges, but it turns out that some significant minority of them just plain, bribing people to cheat about it, as we now know.
Right. It's probably important that we make a distinction here that what has recently made the headlines, this bribery cheating scandal, is the most extreme version of what you're talking about. What's probably far more significant are all of the ways that are, in a sense, perfectly legal, perfectly permissible, in ways in which the people who are already at the top
desirable.
Are staying there. Right.
And in some cases, desirable. So, if you have a family, if you have a, someone who's, made, billions in a hedge fund, and he donates, $1 billion or $100 million to some university, and that enables it to provide scholarships to some people and enables it to, to build a cancer research center that, that is developing, let's hope, a cure for cancer. I mean, that's not an awful thing. You can't say, oh, my God, that's terrible. But if in the back of his mind or even in the front of his mind, he's doing it because he knows he has a child or a grandchild who's going to apply to that school, that's not the same as bribing a soccer coach to say that, the kid's a soccer recruit. But it still is using an advantage that other people don't have. And I don't know what the solution to that is. I mean, I think, the whole idea of meritocracy is just very confusing because you can't confuse meritocracy with fairness because no aspect of the system is fair. I may have a natural instinct for standardized tests, which in fact it turns out I did, and someone else may not, but does that make them less of a deserving person? Does it even make them less likely to succeed in real life? Hard to say that it does.
You are pointing to a divided America, which you describe differently than some people do when it comes to us being a divided people, a divided nation. And you put it in a couple of different ways, and I think it helps frame all that you explore in your book, that for you this is not about right versus left or progressive versus conservative or any other way, not even necessarily rich and poor quite that simply, but you like to think of it as a divided America between the protected and the unprotected. Why do you think that's an a helpful framework within which to view this?
I'm glad you asked that question, because that is probably the key point of the book and the key point of the challenges we face. What do I mean by protected versus unprotected? Well, it's confusing in terms of politics, because I could argue, I will argue, that a civil servant who is in charge of, you know, the Veterans Hospital in Phoenix, this is an example I use in the book, who is running a hospital where they're doctoring the information on the waiting lists to make it look like, you know, there aren't long waiting lists, and, you know, that erupts in a whole scandal. The idea that that person, because of civil service protections, can't be fired for doing that, and in fact was not fired for doing that because the civil service court, there's a special court, ruled that she was never explicitly instructed not to have doctored waiting lists. I mean, that's just ridiculous, and, you know, it takes 2 years. Or the fact that a member of the teachers' union in New York, which is something I wrote about in a fairly well-known article in the New Yorker, and then wrote a book about this, was protected through a 2-year arbitration process, even though she never prepared lesson plans, never marked her students' papers, just never did anything. So those people who you don't necessarily associate with the upper class are protected. They're protected the same way the CEO of a mega bank was protected in the crash of 2008-2009. There was all this bad stuff going on at these banks, but the CEOs were all able to claim that the bank is so big that how could they know and how could they be held responsible for what was going on, you know, 8 layers below them in an office, you know, halfway around the other side of the world. So the bank CEOs are protected. A lot of civil servants are protected, even though the majority of civil servants are heroes in my book. But the bad ones, the incompetent ones are protected. If you're a union worker in the private sector, you are no longer protected. You used to be protected in the 50s and 60s by labor laws that worked to keep a level playing field. And that protection for union workers in the private sector is just gone. So they're an unprotected class. If you're a bank or a credit card company, as I point out in Tailspin, you got all these arbitration clauses written into the boilerplate of what you sign up for when you sign up for a credit card or a cell phone. And the arbitration clauses basically say you cannot bring a lawsuit against us. You can't bring a class action. So if I'm a cell phone company and I cheat you out of $8 a month, but I cheat the other 4 million customers out of $8 a month, the 4 million people can't get together and hire a lawyer, which is what a class action is, and bring a lawsuit. And it's certainly not worth it for you for your $8 a month to hire a lawyer to do it. So the people at the top of the credit card company, the cell phone company, they're protected, but their consumers are not protected by our court system, by our civil laws, the way they used to be.
You call us at one point a nation of moats, M-O-A-T-S, in terms of those who are
protection
in a position.
Versus and the overall breakdown, what it really relates to is for any society to function, you know, particularly a democratic society, it depends on two things, responsibility and accountability. If you have a sense of responsibility for the common good, and if you're accountable for breaching that responsibility for the common good, then the country works. But if you can evade your responsibility for the common good, whether it's by, cheating your cell phone customers or being a banker who causes the crash, and you're not held responsible for it, the whole sense of a community really collapses, because the people who are unprotected and see that there's a protected class, they lose all confidence in the system. They don't turn out to vote as often. They're cynical. They retreat to right-wing corners and left-wing corners, and, you know, they tend to, want to accept more extreme versions of political leadership because they're just so frustrated.
Right, and looking for simple solutions. We should say, I know we're just about out of time, but we should say that your book is not just a grim slog through things that should not be, but you do point to at least isolated instances of hope that some of this might be changed, and that there are even some voices from this very meritocracy that you talk about who are
exactly.
speaking out and seeing the problem and trying to point it out to the rest of us.
Not only speaking it, but doing things. I mean, there are people who, against all odds and arguably, you know, all common sense, are, you know, going to work every day, you know, working for nonprofits, trying to reform the campaign finance system, trying to provide the job training that was lost in the 70s to move people into the middle class. There are all kinds of groups and people who are working away because they haven't become as cynical and as hopeless as a lot of the rest of us.
Well, all of this and more is explored in your fascinating book called Tailspin, The People and Forces Behind America's 50-Year Fall and Those Fighting to Reverse It, a vintage paperback, a division of Penguin Random House, the author Stephen Brill. Stephen Brill, thank you for making time in your busy schedule to talk with me about your fascinating book.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show Archive. We're going to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show with one of the country's most talented and successful writers, Steve Barry. You may know that name from a number of best-selling novels that he has written, I think 9 or 10 by now, around the figure of Cotton Malone, and several other novels as well. He's extremely successful. And this latest novel, yet another in the Cotton Malone series, is called The Patriot Threat. And like most of Steve Barry's works, it is rooted in American history. In this particular case, rooted in a reality that involves the laws that brought into being our income tax and the possibility that if indeed that legislation was somehow fatally flawed, and in fact there is no reason for us to have income tax, think of what a secret, what a powerful secret that could be in the hands of someone who, in a sense, wanted to disable the United States in a fiduciary fashion. That's just one ingredient in this really thrilling novel by Steve Barry, which, by the way, is, in a sense, kind of a book within a book. And we'll explain that in just a moment. The book is published by Minotaur Books. Again, it's called The Patriot Threat. And Steve Barry, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Talk for a moment about this genre in which you are working, that this is not just a novel, but a novel that is, and not just a thriller, but a thriller that is based in history with some intriguing historical facts that are woven into the mix. Talk a moment about this interesting niche in which you like to write.
Yeah, I like to take something from the past, something forgotten, something you may not know anything about, and get you to learn more about it. And that's the hook that I go through. That's the hook as I put it together. And in this case, it was something that happened 100 years ago with the ratification of the 16th Amendment, something that's real, that really did happen. The Solicitor General at the time warned the Secretary of State that there was problems in the ratification process. He told the Secretary of State to move with caution here, but the Secretary of State ignored that advice and declared the 16th Amendment in effect. He didn't declare it ratified, which is very interesting. He said in effect. And the amendment took over. About 20 years ago, someone went behind that to find out what the Solicitor General was actually upset about and discovered something quite shocking. In nearly all 42 states that considered the amendment, there were problems. In 15 of the states, there were problems so severe that they most likely did not even ratify the amendment. You only have to void six states to void the amendment. And so it's just this fascinating thing that happened so long ago that could have catastrophic consequences today. So I wove this thriller using this as a weapon against us.
Let's talk for a moment about the title character, not the title character, but the central character in the novel, for the sake of any of our listeners who are not familiar with who Cotton Malone is.
Yeah, he's a retired Justice Department agent. He lives in Copenhagen. He runs an old bookshop and kind of stays in trouble all the time. He's had 10 adventures now. I don't write them, though, where you have to read them in order or anything. You can read them in any order you want, and I write them almost like standalones in some respects. And so he's been around a little while, and now he gets caught up in this constitutional crisis. And it's for the first time I was able to do the whole thriller in 23 hours. So everything happens in this book really fast. And the reader is going to find out some cool stuff about Franklin Roosevelt and Andrew Mellon and the $1 bill and a painting that hangs in the National Gallery of Art. It's there in Gallery 62. A man named Hyman Solomon, who helped finance the American Revolution. All of this is going to be woven around this constitutional crisis that Cotton gets caught up in.
And, of course, because it's a thriller, just about everything that happens is cloaked in a deep veil of secrecy. One of the dynamics that is especially interesting in the book, and I should think to at least some extent very true to life, is the fact that we have, in a sense, different government agencies not fully cooperating with each other. In many cases, not cooperating at all.
No.
And being very possessive of the secrets which each of them sort of hold in their pocket. And for understandable reasons to a point, but we're also sort of painted this very vivid picture of how that can really undermine their own respective efforts.
Yeah. You're trying to keep your own little secrets in your own little niche. But unfortunately, they're spilling over, and that's part of the novel illustrates that, of how this happens. Treasury Department has a secret in which they don't want anyone else to know. And unfortunately, you know, it gets out, and once it gets out, then it becomes just a disaster across the board, and, you know, everyone's trying to plug this leak gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And, you know, That's part of what I wanted to illustrate somewhat, was how the left hand and the right hand sometimes in the intelligence business has no idea what they're doing. And in this case, it could have catastrophic consequences because of what's happening out there. I have a rogue North Korean. I was fascinated with North Korea. This is an interesting country I know almost nothing about. And I wanted to learn more about it. I wanted the reader to know more about it. But, you know, really, North Korea can't hurt us. It's more a nuisance than anything else. It's not really anything that causes us any serious harm unless they could get a hold of something that they could use our own laws against us. They could turn our own rules against us. And that's what this rogue North Korean is after. He's after his birthright, and he's going to take America down. And I modeled him after a real guy. The actual leader of North Korea right now was not supposed to be the leader of North Korea. His older brother was supposed to have that job. But his older brother tried to take one of his children and sneak into Japan to go to Disneyland. He got caught, and he embarrassed his father, and his father stripped him of his birthright. And that's why we have the leader we have now. And that older brother still lives in Macau and is still alive, so I loosely based my antagonist on what happened to him.
Mm. And, of course, one of the things that makes him a dangerous figure is because he is widely viewed as shallow and directionless and so on. And in fact, he is a very, very smart man and a very dangerous man because everybody around him so seriously underestimates
him. That's the whole point. And he likes that. He likes to be underestimated. And he works under the radar. And now he's at the point where he's about to pull this off. unfortunately for him, Cot Malone gets in the middle of it, and that's where the thriller aspect of all this comes in. But there's just there's a lot of real things in the book. I try to keep my books about 90% to reality. I only trip it up about 10% of the time for the entertainment value. And I have a writer's note in the back, though, that tells you where I trip you up.
Mm. And in other words, it really spells out the whole matter of fact versus fiction.
Yes, and I want you to know that. I don't want you to leave the book thinking something is real and it's not. It's usually the other way around. You're going to think something's false, and you're going to discover that it's real because, as I said, I keep the book about 90% close to reality.
Mm. We're speaking with Steve Barry about his latest novel, which is called The Patriot Threat. It's one of a number of books which he has written, thrillers involving a figure called Cotton Malone, once an elite intelligence division officer within the Justice Department, and now on his own in semi-retirement, but pulled out of semi-retirement again and again. In fact, talk about the small elite group which he now is affiliated with.
Yeah, I created the Magellan Billet. It was just something I made up one day because I thought, well, why don't the Justice Department have something that can work for the Attorney General and do what needs to be done in a covert way? So I created this concept of the Magellan Billet. Cotton retired out a few years ago, and he moved to Copenhagen, and he runs that old bookshop, but he just can't help it. He just gets keep drawing back in, and I transitioned Cotton a little bit for a while. He was drawn back in because of things happening to his friends and family, those kind of things, these personal reasons to bring him back in, but, you know, after a while, you kind of run out of those, so he's kind of transitioned now into an agent for hire, and he kind of gets hired back in, and for what he thinks is one thing, which quickly become something else, and that's what happens here. A simple little meet and greet recon mission turns into this big 23-hour adventure that he has to, you know, go across Venice and Croatia to deal with, while my other character, Stephanie Nell, who heads the Magellan Billet, is in Washington, D.C., dealing with that aspect of it. And all of this is happening simultaneously as this constitutional crisis begins to unravel.
Talk for a moment about constructing a thriller that plays out on several stages simultaneously, and stages that are all over the world. I'm really impressed at the clarity with which this novel unfolds, for as complicated as the story in fact is, and how tightly packed that story is.
Thank you. I work hard on that, because you've got to make sure that what's happening in one side of the world has relevance to what's happening on the other side of the world. And it only has relevance in the reader's mind because the reader is actually privileged to both worlds. And so they're parallel, but they are somewhat intertwined with one another and interconnected. And that's what makes them work, is that interconnection. And I keep that connection going until eventually these two worlds hit up to each other and butt up to each other. Now, in this case, they only butt up to each other from the standpoint of the plot. They still stay separated and from one side of the globe to the other. But I have to be careful to keep them as close to one another as I can in the reader's mind. Otherwise, you'll get confused. And, you know, this time I thought I kept them pretty tight.
Hmm. So you, as you have already talked about, are utilizing a couple of people from our own history who really lived.
Yeah.
And one of them was this man by the name of Chaim Salomon.
Chaim Salomon, yeah.
You call him in the writer's note one of the unsung heroes of the American Revolution.
No question.
Tell us why we should know his name and how you utilize his legacy in this novel.
Well, we should know him very much so, because he's the man who financed the American Revolution. You can't run a war without money. And he's the guy that found the money to keep the revolution going. And he also loaned the country $800,000 of his own money that kept the country going. And Washington was so appreciative of what Chaim Salomon did that he asked him, what would you like as a thank you? Salomon says, I don't want anything for me, but I'd like something for my community. And he was Jewish. So Washington said, okay, fine, this is what I'll do. On the Great Seal of the United States, above the eagle, on the back of the $1 bill, you can see the Great Seal. Above the eagle are 13 stars. And those stars supposedly were arranged to form a perfect Star of David in appreciation to Hyman Solomon. Solomon died in 1785. He never actually saw the country formed. Five times Congress has considered repayment of the money we owe Solomon. Five times Congress has said no. That debt today would be worth somewhere around $300 billion, and we've never paid him back. So to me, Solomon is as much a founding father as any of the others that we recognize.
Right. And of course, one of the contentions of your novel is that if there were somehow proof, evidently proof that, in fact, ultimately disappeared, that such a debt in fact was owed,
yeah.
If proof of that could be somehow recovered or rediscovered, it would put the United States in a very uncomfortable position.
Very much so, an embarrassing position, too. What happened was the documentation for the notes that were owed to Solomon were turned over to the Pennsylvania treasurer in right after his death in 1785, and that documentation just vanished. It just disappeared. And that's how Congress has refused to pay the debts back, because they say we don't have any proof that we owe him any money. Even though history says we do, they don't have any documentary proof of it.
How about the figure of Andrew Mellon? I suspect a real student of American history might know who Mr. Mellon was, but many Americans would probably have no notion or only the vaguest notion.
Richest, most powerful man in America in the 1920s. Served as Secretary of Treasury for 11 years across three different presidents, which, by the way, is a tough thing to do. I hypothesized in the novel how he managed to pull that off. Franklin Roosevelt hated him, and Mellon hated Roosevelt. They had a blood feud between them. Roosevelt hated him so bad that he had him indicted for tax evasion. Mellon beat the charge, but these two men just went at it, and finally they met face-to-face on December 31st, 1936 in the White House, and that is the prologue of the novel, when these two people finally come together, and that's where the National Gallery of Art was born. I just added another element to their feud to make it even deeper and more intense, and that forms the basis of the Patriot Threat. But it was fascinating to study Mellon because he was such a powerful man behind the scenes, and he was so wealthy. And he's one of those guys we don't know a whole lot about, but we need to.
We've already touched on what in many respects is kind of the central matter here, the controversy which surrounds the creation and the ratification of the 16th Amendment to the Constitution, which of course is why all of us pay income taxes. And question has been drawn up about that process by which that ratification took place. When you kind of outline some of this in the writer's note, you say that whether these charges or concerns are in fact fully true, you leave that to the reader to determine. I think what you're saying there is you're not insisting that they're absolutely truthful, but if they're true, they make for fascinating grist for a novel.
There you go. Yeah, this is not a manifesto for not paying your taxes. We all got to pay our taxes. And it's a novel which by definition is not real. What it is, though, is bringing to your attention something that happened 100 years ago, something that is true, that really did happen, something that has some fascinating implications and some just interesting aspects to it. And hopefully the reader will want to learn a little bit more about that and take a look at some of that. I've done several books now with the Constitution and some of these constitutional quirks. I'm fascinated by the flaws and quirks in our Constitution. And I've explored two or three of those, and I've still got a couple of more to go. And this is one that just I came across, and I just couldn't resist. It just, as I said, made for a really good thriller.
Right. And, of course, I think for a lot of us living in modern America, we are intrigued by the notion that documents from over a century ago or a transaction which occurred more than 200 years ago could have such direct relevance to us today.
That's right. That's all of my books deal with that. Something from the past that's still relevant today. That's the what I call the so what. You know, who cares if the 16th Amendment wasn't ratified properly? Well, okay, I'll show you why we care in a so what. Someone could use that as a weapon against us. since, as I said, the government derives 90% of its revenues from income tax, what if they were able to avoid that and turn our own laws against us? It's like, as one of the characters in the book says, it's the cleverest weapon of mass destruction ever.
The book, again, is called The Patriot Threat, and it's published by Minotaur Books. It's the latest Cotton Malone novel by Steve Barry. Steve Barry, a great pleasure for me to speak with you on The Morning Show about your very exciting newest book. Best wishes to you.
Thank you, sir.
Support for The Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019, a unique